This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. General Pervez Musharraf took control of Pakistan 2 years ago in a bloodless coup. Holding on to that power may be another matter. Just 9 days into the U.S. assault on Afghanistan, at least 8 Pakistanis have died in violent anti-American protests. And according to a new Newsweek poll, a sizable but less vocal majority regards Osama bin Laden as a holy warrior, someone to be supported. Is Musharraf risking his regime for a role in America's war against terror? This hour, we'll talk about Pakistan. Is the country flirting with meltdown? But first, Secretary of State Colin Powell's mission to Pakistan. Powell arrived in Islamabad today just as India shelled Pakistani positions in Kashmir, breaking a 10-month ceasefire. These new tensions could only complicate Powell's discussions with President Musharraf, who's also battling hardline Islamic groups that oppose his alliance with the United States. Earlier today, I spoke to BBC correspondent Susanna Price in Islamabad about the repeated calls from Pakistani leaders for a swift end to the bombing in Afghanistan.
Is really the growing domestic opposition here. Religious hardliners who support the Taliban have been holding almost daily protests. Some of those have turned violent. But what they're particularly worried about is ordinary public opinion. People here don't support the American raids generally. They're very worried about civilians being killed. They have close links between the Pakistanis and the Afghans. And I think President Musharraf is looking for that public opinion. He's making sure that ordinary people don't start getting mobilized and don't get called out onto the streets. That kind of effect could threaten his position.
We read reports today of a Gallup poll in Pakistan saying that there's general support for Musharraf's handling of the Afghan crisis, but overwhelming backing for the Taliban against the United States.
I found that quite surprising, to be honest. I think there is a lot of animosity towards the United States. That existed before because of the American Middle East policy, and it was very much perceived here as being pro-Israeli. So I think you get a lot of anti-American feeling and a lot of feeling here that the Americans are attacking Afghanistan without a well-thought-out plan, that ordinary people are being hurt. But I don't think there's a huge groundswell of opinion in favor of the Taliban from what I've heard. And I think a lot of people realize that if President Musharraf had backed the Taliban, Pakistan would have been absolutely isolated. So while people are anti-American in some senses, I think they're also realists and they know that the Taliban option was not a viable option.
Susanna, what could Colin Powell offer President Musharraf to help him deal with his domestic stress? Other than a speedier campaign, which we know he'll ask for, what else could Powell do?
The fact that Colin Powell is here, I think, is helping. It's showing that Pakistan is in the loop. It's seen as an important part of the coalition. Pakistan sees itself as a frontline state, and I think it wants to show that it's being taken notice of. I think Colin Powell is going to offer some kind of military cooperation, although not the supply of arms. There may be talk about some kind of development aid as well, but I just think his very presence, the fact now we've had the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, now we've got Colin Powell, it shows that Pakistan is coming back in from the cold, especially important because President Musharraf took power in a coup 2 years ago, and Pakistan was largely isolated from the international community, and this is a complete turnaround.
Is there any sense that Colin Powell might pressure India to be more responsive to Pakistan's concerns around Kashmir, where they've had an ongoing conflict? Might he do that and through that help Musharraf with public opinion inside Pakistan?
I think definitely Kashmir is on the agenda, although the Americans aren't really coming out with any suggestion they have a plan or a way of solving it. I think what they're trying to do is to persuade both Pakistan and India that the time is right to have talks, that they're both on the same side in this international coalition against terror, and that it could be the time. Perhaps they'll be trying to talk to Pakistan about reining in the militants. They maybe talk to India about the conditions inside Indian administered Kashmir. So I think it's really a time for them to try and bring the two sides together, but I don't think they're coming here with a solution. But, of course, any movement on the issue of Kashmir will help President Musharraf.
U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice was scheduled to appear today on the Arab satellite television channel Al Jazeera, where Osama bin Laden has repeatedly been televised with his statements. Is that an effective means for U.S. officials to get their perspective on the conflict to people in the Muslim world, in Pakistan in particular?
Well, I think some people are watching Al Jazeera, but people here who have satellite television and have access to those kind of things are also watching CNN and the BBC. So I don't think it would be particularly useful targeted at Pakistan. But people are interested to watch Al Jazeera more, though, for the images, obviously, that are coming out of Kabul and Afghanistan, which, of course, get rebroadcast as well on the international networks.
And the overall mood then in Pakistan now, Susanna, mounting concern over instability, or are they becoming accustomed to the conflict next door?
I think they are. No, they're growing increasingly concerned about the conflict, about the length of it. They're increasingly concerned about what the Americans actually think they're going to achieve, whether they're really going to find Osama bin Laden, and also increasing concern about what the coalition is going to put in if it succeeds in toppling the Taliban. Pakistan is particularly worried about the Northern Alliance. It doesn't want to see them taking power alone. It wants a broad-based government, and it wants to ensure there isn't a vacuum in which the Northern Alliance simply sweeps down. It wants things in place before the Taliban are toppled.
Susanna Price is the BBC correspondent in Pakistan. I spoke to her earlier from Islamabad. We're talking about the growing unrest in Pakistan this hour. Its leaders have nervously supported America's war against the Taliban, but its Islamic religious groups have mounted fierce opposition. On Sunday, police fired on thousands of stone-throwing protesters marching on the airbase where U.S. forces are launching flights over Afghanistan. At least two protesters died. Are we watching the unraveling of Pakistan? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. With us this evening is Aisha Jalal, a professor of history at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, and the author of Self and Sovereignty, The Muslim Individual and the Community of Islam in South Asia. Good evening, Professor Jalal.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Also with us is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, joining us tonight from Vermont Public Radio. Hello, Jack.
Hi, John.
Professor Jalal, if we could start with you, there's been concern throughout the last month over how Pakistan would respond to everything that's come out of Afghanistan. That concern clearly remains keen. Why is it so keen? What is the worst case scenario that Washington planners have to deal with when looking at Pakistan?
I think it's important to strike a balance, and a delicate one at that, between an alarmist sort of perspective on Pakistan and one that is complacent. There's no question that Pakistan is in a very difficult corner as a result of the American action in Afghanistan. But at the same time, I think that we must not assume that all is lost. I mean, the situation is serious, but perhaps not hopeless. There has been some sort of an opportunity also to see whether Pakistan can be brought back on course. There has been a sense that it has been sort of drifting towards a kind of extremism. Now, whether this is in fact the way Pakistan will go, as I think, is a big question mark. The worst case scenario, as far as the U.S. and for that matter anyone in the region concerned with the region would be basically a civil war scenario. But that wouldn't happen until and unless the army begins to show signs of cracking. Violent protests, sporadic ones, Pakistan can absorb, but any rift in the army would be the really serious problem.
General Musharraf took steps only recently to remove some noted Taliban supporters from the higher ranks of the military. But there are also reports that as much as a third of the military considers itself a fundamentalist Muslim. How secure, how sound is the military behind President Musharraf at this point?
Well, once a decision is made, even if it's made after a considerable disagreement, the Pakistan Army historically tends to back the commander. And one would hope that that would be the case, even if there are people with doubts about the policy that he is pursuing. But there's no indication thus far that, despite disagreements, there is actual opposition that he's facing from within the army.
And assuming that Pakistan comes through this difficult patch that it's in right now, could there in fact be a silver lining here? Are there ways in which Pakistan might find itself realigned with the international community after some years of ostracism?
Well, I think there's no question about that. And I think that is the opportunity I was referring to earlier, that there is a possibility of a turnabout, but that will take time. And a lot depends on how things proceed in Afghanistan.
Aisha Jalal, why is Pakistan so suspicious of U.S. intentions?
Well, it's a long history. Throughout the Cold War period, Pakistan was considered to be one of the most allied of allies in the U.S.'s containment of communism policy. But Pakistan felt let down on repeated occasions, beginning with the 65 war with India, when all military aid was and ammunition was suspended, then perhaps most dramatically following Pakistan's support and offered support to the effort to dislodge the Soviets from Afghanistan. And Pakistan in 1990 felt completely abandoned by the U.S. And that's when the particular policy of backing the Taliban seems to have come to fruition.
Jack Beattie, I know you've been watching this with great interest. Clearly, Washington is attuned to the risks here. Colin Powell's putting a positive, forward-looking face on his visit there, but they also have real-time current concerns.
Yeah, they do. And there have been rifts between the administration and Pakistan. Just last week, General Musharraf said that he had had an agreement. He had heard from the administration that this was going to be a, quote, brief campaign, a short campaign, and a campaign quickly short on what he called visuals, or what someone in the Pakistan government called visuals, that is to say, bombs on television. And then President Bush said, no, there was no such agreement. This is going to take as long as it takes. It seems to me, and I wonder what Professor Jalal says about this, the time is really the duration of this campaign in Afghanistan is really the sort of key factor here in keeping the lid on in Pakistan. Is that your sense, Professor Jalal?
Yes, it is. I think not just the question of time, but what happens during this time. One of the reasons why there is growing pressure on the regime is that people, even who don't support the extremist groups or, for that matter, Osama bin Laden, believe that these bombings are basically this decision to bomb is incorrect and immoral.
Professor Jalal, can you pick apart for us the Pakistani perspective on this? There's word of very widespread support for Osama bin Laden there. What is the source of that?
The source of that is, first of all, they don't see him as someone who has carried out terrorist activities, and that's one issue. The other thing is that he's seen to be a crusader for causes that have been very difficult for the Muslim world, particularly Palestine, the situation of innocents in Iraq who've been subjected to bombing, and number three, the situation presented by the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia. Which is deemed to be a holy land, and that in fact is a very powerful reason why Osama bin Laden's politics have had an effect on people who are also reeling for a variety of reasons and the economic problems, the economic stagnation, their political problems, social instability. So all of these are somehow these discontents are being channeled in the absence of any concerted attempt to channel them anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw, as you alluded to, kind of incredibly in this Gallup poll, that a full 50% of Pakistanis polled believed that it was actually Israel behind the 9/11 attacks.
Well, that's exactly the point. If that is the sort of belief, we are dealing with a belief system, and nothing is really being done to effectively combat that. Instead, we have a military policy in place in Afghanistan, which is only fueling this sort of suspicion, which does exist.
Jack Beattie, do you feel that Washington is being straightforward with the American public about the risks we're dealing with here, or is it just that they're confident they're going to get through this difficult pass quickly and be on firmer ground?
Well, I don't think they're being very lucid about this. I mean, this has been left to the press. I don't know that the president has been questioned about the Pakistan imbroglio and complications. And sure, they're hoping to get it past them quickly, but I note that last week the British admiral, who's in charge of the British forces there, said, no, this campaign is going to go perhaps into the early summer. And I thought, well, people in the Pakistani government must be wincing when they read that. And I'm just wondering how deep the understanding is within the administration. They have their political problem, which is Americans expect them to go after bin Laden, where he is. And the Pakistani complication is not been part of the sort of war message we've heard.
Jack, we've got to take a quick break. Professor Jalal will be right back. We're talking about Pakistan, right next door to Afghanistan, and very on edge with every day that the bombing campaign goes longer. Could we be risking a meltdown? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR in Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Pakistan sitting on the edge of the U.S.-led assault on Afghanistan. The nervousness there among top government officials as Colin Powell has arrived today to talk about the future, talk about the government that may emerge in Afghanistan after the Taliban, and to try and calm the political waters there. What's your view? Are we risking stepping into Osama bin Laden's trap if Pakistan spins out of control, or is this just part of the risk we have to take to address a difficult situation in Afghanistan? Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. A caller, Charlie, is joining us on the line. Welcome, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for having my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. Number one, I believe the survey that indicated that Osama bin Laden was looked upon positively by 50% of the population in Pakistan.
More like 80% for Osama bin Laden there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have to take that. You have to really analyze what that means. I think the population in Pakistan is fairly well educated, bigger middle class than in many other Muslim countries. They must know what's been going on in Afghanistan. And I think that there must be mixed messages in there. But another point I wanted to make very quickly is that when we talk about the danger of this escalating out of control, we should really go to some of the natural points further down the line. One needs to look at when we talk about a nuclear-empowered Pakistan, What is the nature of their nuclear power? Their nuclear detonation last year, a year and a half ago, I believe, was considered by most scientists with knowledge to be something close to a dud. Yes, they do have a nuclear capability. Then one has to look at that nuclear capability, their ability to deliver it, et cetera. One also needs to bring India, with a considerably greater nuclear power at its disposal right next door. Mm. This would, of course, create a horrendous situation. But I really feel that it's very important to look at what rational minds who are controlling most of these countries will really allow. And I think that Pakistan and the Pakistani population, government, and civil society would veer very far away from something like a Taliban-like or Osama bin Laden-led government taking control, because it would just spell a most terrible future for the area. And I think that that alarmism is something that we really need to avoid here.
We're looking to avoid that, Charlie. We take your point. We take your several good points. Let me put some of these to Aisha Jalal. First, Aisha Jalal, Charlie's saying that rational minds here would not will avoid a meltdown because it wouldn't make sense for Pakistan or for the region. And I guess what we're doing is balancing that against sentiment and anger. Do you have that same confidence that rational minds will prevail?
Well, I hope so, certainly. And I wouldn't sort of, I mean, the poll is somewhat suspect.
Sure.
I think that what's happening is that a number of strands of dissent and unhappiness are all being put together. I mean, you know, I don't know what kind of poll this was, what sort of question was posed. Mm-hmm. But if you're saying that do you support American action in military action against Afghanistan, well, many more people probably would say no, they don't. But does that translate into support for an extremist right-wing government that would lead Pakistan into a war with India and potentially nuclear explosions between the two? Then I don't think that would be the sort of view that even this poll would represent. I mean, people are rational. They would like. I mean, they want to get on with their lives.
Sure. Charlie, the caller also raised some doubt about the effectiveness of Pakistan's nuclear weapons threat. But is it that are we that sure that it's a so-called dud? It seems to be a working weapon.
Are you opposing this to me?
Yes.
Well, I mean, they've said much the same for India's, if I may sort of correct the caller, because that was the estimation of both sets of nuclear tests on the part of the two countries, that they were really not all that effective. But there's no question that they do have nuclear capacity. In fact, from what I recall, the Pentagon suggested that Pakistan's delivery system may even have an edge against India.
Mm-hmm. And certainly when they set off their tests, we were taken by surprise, and they did show up on the Richter scale. Jack Beattie, Charlie's final point was an interesting one about the education of the population in Pakistan. And We've been reading about that only yesterday in the Times, interestingly, about the Islamic education going on in some of the so-called madras schools there. It's not one that leads to a very friendly attitude toward the United States.
No, that was a shocking piece, just because it showed, first of all, just how desperately poor young people come to these schools, and they put their hands in the hands of they put their faith and education in the hands of these professors, teachers, who teach them a kind of black and white version of the world, and we're in the black. They talked to one student who had actually heard on the BBC the world's version of what happened on September 11th, and then he went and he heard his teacher's version, and he said, "Oh no, I believe the teacher. It's the Israelis who did that." And I have seen an interview with someone described as a professor of medicine in Pakistan who studied in the West, who said, "Oh no, that was the Israelis." Mm-hmm. So this sense that there are two how amenable to the American line the Pakistani consciousness is these days, I just don't know. It strikes me as if we have tremendous burdens just of basic understanding and distrust to get over, and not least because, as Professor Jalal points out, here we are back a decade later having used these people to get at Afghanistan 10 years ago. Now we're back again using them once more to get at Afghanistan. And I can quite imagine people thinking, when is this great power going to leave us alone and stop using us as a player in its great chessboard?
Aisha Jalal, do you sense that alienation being widespread? Why do people send their children to schools that would teach them such anti-American sentiment?
This is just a segment of society that's heading to the madrasas and being indoctrinated there. It's mm-hmm. by no means the majority, but there's no question that this is related to the failure of the state to provide education for all. Mm-hmm. And these madrasas not only provide students with an education, but they provide them with clothing and food. So this is a kind of a social service that's being provided. And because of the economic crisis in Pakistan, which has really been there for decades now, this has been on the increase. Not all madrasas in Pakistan are teaching hatred for the U.S., but a good number are in over the last 10, 15 years. And that's really the problem that we are facing.
And presumably, the students coming out of these schools will be most open to believing the worst of the United States in the current conflict.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the cultural sort of antagonism is being played on. Religion is being treated in a particular way, a particular version of religion. But I really think that we are in danger in the U.S. of only looking at the worst sort of case scenario in terms of the mm-hmm. trouble that mm-hmm. this whole thing poses. I mean, the vast majority of Pakistanis you'd find if you were to sort of, if the cameras were to go there or mm-hmm. even the radio stations were to go there, that the people have moderate views.
We'll take comfort in that. I want to bring into our conversation Gerald Hillman. He's a member of the U.S. Defense Policy Board. He's written about the risks that are being run as operations are carried out next door to Pakistan. Good evening, Gerald Hillman.
Hello. Hi.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
From your view, what are the risks in the continued bombing of Afghanistan next door to Pakistan? How could that ripple through to Pakistan?
Most of the risks have already been identified in the conversation, but the risk of disturbances among the Pakistani people, I don't think that there is an alternative, as was stated before, to the current leadership. So I have doubts that the army would support a change in that leadership at this time. Mm-hmm. But I think that it could, if there were considerable unrest, limit the options of the Pakistani government in supporting the Americans.
And do you think that the steps taken so far by the U.S. to try and reach out to Pakistan have reduced those risks?
Well, I think we've had very little time to reach out to the Pakistanis. We've had our hands full. Mm-hmm. I think we've got to address many of the questions that have been raised about whether we can secularize education in Pakistan in the long term and reach the Pakistani people with our point of view in the short term.
What do you think is the most important message that Colin Powell can deliver to President Musharraf on his visit and meeting tomorrow?
Well, Colin Powell has got to answer some questions, first of all, for the Pakistanis, and that was raised earlier. But he has to first tell them his opinion, his assessment of the situation, and how long he thinks this campaign is going to take, and what is needed in order to bring the operation to a close. Then beyond that, he has to be able to provide the current government with support and incentives and something to deliver in return for the support that they've given us, because they've already made defining choices about their country by supporting us.
Let's take a quick call. We're talking about Pakistan, the risks we're running there as we continue our bombing in Afghanistan, and potentially the silver lining of Pakistan being pulled back into the international community. Are we stepping into a trap set by Osama bin Laden, or are we moving ahead in the only way we can, building coalitions and pursuing the war on terrorism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Join us. Laura is on the line. Welcome, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm very pessimistic. I agree with those Pakistanis who think that the U.S. doesn't know where this policy is heading. In the front page of the Times today, the report was that the military policy is outstripping the political policy. And I think we already played into bin Laden's hands. What would he have expected us to do? Bomb Afghanistan. That's precisely what he would have expected us to do. Now, I'm not sure what else to do, but not having had another alternative doesn't mean that it was a reason to do that. And I'm also pessimistic because I don't see, on the other hand, how we're ever going to combat a view such as the Israelis did it. I mean, I don't even know where you go from there.
What do you say to that?
Right.
That's right. Laura, thanks for your call. Gerald Hillman, let me put that to you. What about this notion that bombing in Afghanistan the way we've done is playing into Osama bin Laden's hand?
Well, there is some truth in that, because Osama bin Laden is given a chance to posture tremendously because of bombing, since, as people have said, the sympathy for the innocent victims of military attacks in Afghanistan is very spontaneous in Pakistan, and it's very natural, and he can play on that. And, of course, the more he can excite the Pakistani people and upset the Pakistani people, the more he can deter their leadership from supporting the Americans.
Gerald Hillman, thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Aisha Jalal, professor of history at Tufts. Today, India broke a 10-month truce in Kashmir and sent bombs and flamethrowers and machine gun fire and lots of aggressive action toward the Pakistani emplacements there, just on the eve of Colin Powell's visit to Islamabad. And what do you make of that?
Well, it's a pointed message to Pakistan. India is trying to use this moment, unfortunately, gain some mileage on its dispute with Pakistan on Kashmir. The message is quite clear that so long as Pakistan continues to back what India calls cross-border terrorism and what Pakistan calls a freedom struggle, then India will now respond with the use of heavy military might.
Is it a way of saying also to Colin Powell, don't think you can soft-pedal the depth of our conflict here?
And to make sure that America doesn't sort of buy Pakistan's line on this at all. The problem, of course, on Kashmir is that India and Pakistan have claims and counterclaims, but everybody's forgetting the most important dimension of Kashmir, which is the people of Kashmir themselves.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Pakistan and the risks being run there as the United States-led coalition pursues its war on terrorism in Afghanistan. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Do you think we're striking the right balance, or are we exposing Pakistan to too much risk? Shah Jihan is on the line. Welcome, Shah Jihan.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
My comment is this. I'm a Pakistani-American mm-hmm. who went to Pakistan. I spent 5 years there in medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, you're slightly misconstruing the level of education there. Pakistanis themselves may not want to admit it, but something like 80% of the population is illiterate. Periodicals, newspapers, the circulation daily is about 100,000, which is, you know, minuscule mm-hmm. of a population of 129 million.
Yes.
So I heard one comment that Pakistan is a well-educated country, and it's not.
One of the callers did assert that, but I think the numbers you're bringing may be closer to the mark. Certainly there's a lot of illiteracy. What's your view as a Pakistani-American who spent time there then? How can Washington effectively get its view to the population of Pakistan? Is there any hope?
Well, it's really tough. I'll tell you, those who are educated from my time spent there, they don't like the Taliban, but the government itself has its own perspective and will act in its own accord. Those people who are educated tend mm-hmm. not to vote. They figure it's fruitless. But the way for us to get the message across is just to keep putting it out.
Shah Jahan, thank you very much for your call. Aisha Jalal, what about this issue of literacy rates and American access to the Pakistani populace? What's the picture there?
Well, it's appalling. The literacy rates is quite right. I mean, the Pakistan has atrocious literacy rates, particularly for women. But the people that we see on the streets, I mean, a lot of them are madrasa educated, and the moderate opinion we're talking about is educated. But of course, this is a very small percentage of the society. Most of them are in the rural areas. Almost 65-70% live in the rural areas, mm-hmm. and these are not quite the people who have in the past generally agitated and brought governments down. Governments have been brought down largely in the urban areas on account of trouble in the urban areas. But I do want to point out one thing, and that is, which is we haven't discussed, and that's the fact that there is a very large population of Afghan refugees in Pakistan, about 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. And many of these protests that you have been seeing are precisely in the areas where the refugees are most heavily concentrated.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that the Afghan refugees in Pakistan, in alliance with a number of religious parties, are the ones who are most upset about the bombings and particularly about any kind of American involvement in Afghanistan.
You're suggesting, Aisha Jalal, that these are actually Afghan refugees on the streets?
Not only, but it is interesting if you look at the pattern of these troubles, that they seem to have been more concentrated in places like Balochistan, which has got a very large percentage of Afghan refugees in Peshawar, in the Northwest Frontier Province, and even in the areas in Karachi, that particular neighborhood did have a very large number of Afghans. So naturally, they are responding to what they see as an attack on their country. What is more troubling for Pakistan in the years to come, which will basically affect all its already awful social indicators, is the prospect of another 2 million or so Afghan refugees coming in from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And that will totally destroy the social service structure, which is already very weak in Pakistan.
Jack Beattie, yet another Middle Eastern government we're dealing with, or South Asian here, writing these, as Aisha Jalal says, awful social indicators, an undereducated and poor population with extreme views.
Yeah, and then the war on terrorism, that whole part of it, the part that world poverty plays, has just been left aside. You wonder, and of course this makes me sound like some kind of Quaker or something, but I'm not afraid to sound that way. You wonder if some of the money that was spent on this military venture were spent on basic literacy programs, whether that wouldn't help us far more than what we're doing militarily.
But the game's afoot now. We have to take a quick break. Jack, we'll be right back. We're talking about Pakistan and its role in the current conflict, its vulnerability in the current conflict. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Pakistan, right next door to the conflict now underway in Afghanistan, with all its poverty and vulnerability as the United States pursues its war on terrorism. Our guest this hour is Professor Aisha Jalal, professor of history at Tufts University and author of Self and Sovereignty, the Muslim Individual and the Community of Islam in South Asia. And as always, our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. Jack, you were referring just before the break to how global poverty once again figures into the conflict right here in Pakistan.
Yeah. One of the first programs we did several weeks ago, we learned that the World Bank was undertaking a new initiative to, I don't know, get the level up to $1.50 a day for people around the world from a dollar or something like that, and that one prominent nation was opposing it, and that nation was the United States. You know, our problems, it isn't poverty that produced Bin Laden. That's clear. He's a multimillionaire. But to ignore the alienation, the degradation, the gap between people in the third world and in the first world is probably the most short-sighted step in foreign policy any nation could take. And if anything can come out of this whole business, I hope some recognition of that can come home to our policymakers, that money spent in the third world on education, on literacy, on hunger is the best investment American taxpayers can make.
Aisha Jalal, what about that front? Pakistan was a great friend of the United States for many, many years, and yet it's come out in terrible economic condition. Where does blame lie there? Could Washington have been more supportive?
Well, most of the aid that the U.S. gave went to bolster the military, because Pakistan's main concern, or at least those who were running Pakistan's, their main concern was raising a shield of defense against India. So economic development was really not the main item of concern. And I don't deny that some money did go into developing the infrastructure, but practically none went into social services, with the result that the people have been reeling. And now with the 11th September tragedy, the economic situation for Pakistan is extremely grim. It's been badly hit. Its exports have been badly hit. $1.5 billion worth of exports are believed to be lost in the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. So Pakistan is not, it is really on its knees economically. And with all these sort of regional problems with India, and now the situation in Afghanistan, with American concerns in the region, that is a bigger problem than extremism. Mm-hmm. I don't deny that the two can feed each other, but that, I think, is the bigger problem Pakistan faces.
The fundamental economic weakness.
That's right.
We're talking about Pakistan being buffeted by the new American war on terrorism in Afghanistan. We're at 1-800-423-8255. How do you see the situation there? Avinash is on the line. Welcome, Avinash.
Hello. Wanted to ask a question about how Pakistan would react, you know, if India goes on an offensive in India, Indian-occupied Kashmir.
Mm. That sounds like a short path to trouble, but let's ask. Thanks for your call. What about it, Aish Jalal? India began bombing today after a 10-month ceasefire, but what if New Delhi decided to go on the offensive in this vulnerable time? Can you imagine that, and what might the outcome be?
I mean, the question is going on an offensive in Indian-occupied Kashmir and whether that means an offensive against the militants. Well, I would think that Pakistan would complain, but it has very little modus operandi there. But what has happened today is that there was an attack across the line of control. Mm-hmm. And that attack has been explained by the Indians on the grounds that there was yet another infiltration. I believe about 11 or 12 people were trying to infiltrate, according to the Indians, which they countered, and in the process demolished some Pakistani military positions. Mm-hmm. That's basically what one has heard. But, I mean, it's not clear to me that when we talk about going on the offensive, whether that offensive will be limited to Indian-occupied Kashmir. What would certainly result in a war is if India decides to go in hot pursuit against these militants in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir.
And does Washington have the leverage to restrain India from that at this critical hour?
Well, one hopes so, and I think that one hopes that the Indian establishment itself realizes that this would really be courting disaster. Because, destabilized Pakistan is a nightmare for India as well.
Mm-hmm. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Pikash is on the line. Welcome, Pikash.
Hi. I have a question to Professor Jalal.
Mm.
Being grown up in India since the 70s, what I know of both the regime, to a large extent Pakistan, and even a lot of places in India, these are corrupt regimes, and they have created really the basic economic problems. I believe that the basic economic downgradation of the economy has produced these fundamentalism thoughts in Pakistan and to some parts, to a certain extent, in India as well. I'd like to know her views on those things. Number two is... Does she differentiate between innocent people being killed by bomb blasts, between terrorism and freedom fighting? These are two of my points. I'll take your answers off the air.
Thanks, Pikash. Professor Jalal Pikash is first asking about where responsibility lies in saying Pakistan, among other nations, has had its own corrupt regimes, which may take the lion's share of the blame. Do you agree, or...?
He's partly right, but it's a partial explanation of why extremism has gathered momentum in Pakistan in the last decade or so, certainly two decades. But I think the reason for the extremism in Pakistan is directly related to Pakistan's support of the Mujahideen, Afghan Mujahideen, against the Soviet occupation. There was again a military regime who did have an extremist Islamic agenda, who actually nurtured some of these groups that have now come to their full-fledged power now in Pakistan. And I think that they were tolerated, if not actually encouraged, by certain intelligence agencies associated with the Pakistani state. Mm-hmm. As for the difference between freedom fighting and innocent, obviously there's a big difference. I mean, it's one thing to kill innocent people and another to fight oppression and injustices by the state.
Let's look at the subtext there. I had the feeling that Pikash, an Indian, was tweaking Pakistan on the Kashmir front there, saying that India might see Pakistani freedom fighters in Kashmir as terrorists.
Yes, I think so. I think India would see them as terrorists. Pakistan argues that they are fighting for freedom and against Indian security forces. Let's not forget that there's about 700,000 Indian security forces in the valley. And India has a problem in Kashmir, irrespective of what Pakistan is doing. And even if one manages to put an end to Pakistan's cross-border infiltration or whatever it wants to call it, there will still be a political problem in Kashmir that needs to be addressed. Let's not forget that there's a part of Kashmir under Pakistani control. We do need to focus our attention on the people of Kashmir themselves rather than on these irreconcilable claims and counterclaims between these two countries. And that's what the U.S., I believe, should be encouraging them to take account of.
Jack Beattie, we've just got a few seconds, but there's the tapestry again. One man's freedom fighter, another's terrorist, and it certainly is that weave across Pakistan.
Yeah, and of course the further complication that the Pakistani intelligence services sponsor some of these terrorist groups, or at least that's what one reads in the press. And I'm sure that is a very awkward fact now in U.S.-Pakistan relations, one I expect at least for the short term we're going to overlook. But we're in a war against terrorism to the Indians, and by our definitions, the people, the Pakistani guerrillas are terrorists, and therefore, are they part of our targets here? It's an awkward situation all around.
Aisha Jalal, it's clear this conversation is not nearly over, but our time for it is over. We want to thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming on. And Jack Beattie, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, an American in Morocco. Scott James is a media consultant who lives in San Francisco. Unlike many who were canceling their vacations abroad after September 11th, he decided to take his scheduled trip to Morocco. He was not the object of the anti-American hate he had feared, but briefly, in the city of Fez, Scott James became an ambassador.
I certainly didn't plan it this way. When I first thought of taking a year off to see the world, I thought only of the adventures I'd have. I hoped, maybe, to learn something along the way. Then came the events of September 11th. Like most Americans, I watched the horror unfold on live TV. I cried. I was angry. I was full of hate, and I was afraid. Should I really travel right now? Were Americans really so despised? I refused to believe that. So just 6 days after the attacks, I left on a trip that would take me to Spain, Portugal, and Morocco. I had been to Islamic countries before, but was not prepared for what greeted me in Morocco. Silence. For the first 2 days I spent in the capital city of Rabat, no one would speak to me. No one. They would simply stare with quiet curiosity. Even the merchants in the old marketplace Medina would not approach me. I saw only a few non-Arabs and not a single other American. I had traveled before by myself, but I had never felt so alone. Traveling in Egypt and Turkey in past years, local people chatted me up on every corner. At the very least, someone always wanted to try to sell me something. But despite the lack of tourists in Morocco, no one made a single sales pitch to me. I thought of leaving. Maybe Americans really were as hated as I feared. Or maybe, in a city of 1 million people, the problem wasn't them at all. Maybe the problem was me. Maybe with my latent fears, I was throwing off some sort of vibe that warned people to stay away. I vowed to change and to be more accessible. The next day, I took a train to the ancient city of Fez. When a Moroccan man sat next to me, we started talking. Abdul was a native of Fez, and when we got there, he proudly insisted on showing me his hometown. For 2 days, I got the true insider's tour, incredible warmth and hospitality from a people with few resources to spare. More than that, Abdul introduced me to his circle of friends. Each person, after learning I was American, would express the deepest sorrows for what happened in the attacks. As the first American they had seen in weeks, I was suddenly an ambassador for their grief. They asked me to carry their condolences. But they also wanted me to hear their thoughts on why America was attacked in the first place. They said they feared the world would soon be divided by a war against all Muslims. Somehow, they thought that by talking to me, the only American, they could stop that. One man was remarkably pro-Israel. Palestinians, he claimed, had sold their land and now wrongly complained of being displaced. Another man practically worshipped the Taliban and its severe brand of Islam. And yet another man had venom for just about every Arab nation except his own and could note rivalries that went back centuries. Any delusions I had that all Islamic people thought alike were shattered. Then I met Omar, the manager of a carpet co-op. He took me aside from the others and sat me down in a quiet spot to tell me a story. "My friend," he said, "I am a father of two boys. And because they are boys, sometimes they fight each other. And since fighting is wrong, I must punish them both. I love them both. I cannot pick sides with one son over the other." Omar went on to say how he believes the United States is also a father. As the only remaining superpower, America is now the single parent of the world. And because of that, Omar wanted to know how we could play favorites and choose one fighting child over another. I had no answer for Omar, but his story stayed with me. Yes, it's an oversimplified view of a complex world, but I had never thought of America as so powerful that it's seen as the only grown-up on the entire planet. What an awesome responsibility, and what a target that makes us. I left Morocco a few days later. I admit I was relieved to reach Europe again. Despite my best efforts, I never really let down my guard. But I was glad I went. I learned something. And I got to see the many different faces of Islam. And they got to see mine. In the end, that alone makes it a little harder for fear and hate to thrive.
Scott James is a media consultant who lives in San Francisco. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. You can now listen to or read all the radio diaries featured on special coverage on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. You can also get background information on anthrax and other agents that could be used in a biological attack. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.